Hello, and welcome to the Zenith Bank PLC Full Year 2017 Investor and Analyst Conference Call. Throughout the call, all participants will be in a listen-only mode, and afterwards, there will be a question and answer session. Just to remind you, this conference call is being recorded. Today, I'm pleased to present Mr. Peter Mungo, MD and CEO of Zenith Bank PLC. Please go ahead with your meeting.
Good afternoon. Let me welcome you all to the 2017 group presentation to investors and analysts for Zenith Bank PLC. With me this afternoon, I have Mr. Stanley Amuchie, our Chief Financial Officer. I have Mr. Mukhtar Adam, Assistant General Manager in our Financial Control and Strategic Planning. I have Mike Anyima, our Group Treasurer. I also have two of our Executive Directors, Mr. Dennis Olise and Tope Fashionrote, and finally, our Group Chief Risk Officer, Felix Egbon. Let me start with a brief overview of developments in the banking sector in 2017. 2017 started with a gradual recovery from what we experienced in 2016, but of course, with all its challenges. Nigeria recorded a GDP growth of 1.9% year-on-year in Q4 2017. By the end of 2017, we recovered from the recession. Headline inflation moderated from January 2017 up to date. We ended the year 15.37% in December 2017. As we speak today, the figure for February that was just released was 14.3%, and we hope that this will continue. Exchange rate has been fairly stable on both the INR window and the NYFEX. The INR window has essentially been between 360 and 362, while the NYFEX is on the average 331. The regulatory environment remains very strong, with very tight monetary stance from the Central Bank of Nigeria. We've also witnessed the continuous drop in interest rates and yields on government securities. Amidst all these challenges, we in Zenith Bank, we've been able to weather the storm with a very strong performance, to which our Chief Financial Officer will take us through very shortly. We closed the year very strongly across all parameters with a profit before tax of approximately 204 billion. I'll say it's actually a very respectable figure. I want to hand over to Stanley to take us very briefly through the numbers so that we'll have sufficient time for questions and answers. I want to thank you all for dialing in, and over to Stanley, please.
Okay. Good afternoon, all. I'll be starting from slide nine on the financial highlights. We have anchored our business on efficiency and risk management for superior performance. Over the year, we built a very strong shock-proof balance sheet. Our gross earnings increased to 745 billion, recording an increase year-on-year of 46.7%. We had our net interest income at 258 billion, representing 7.4% year-on-year increase. Also, non-interest income went up 119% year-on-year to 270.6 billion. Our profit before tax was up 30% to 203.5 billion. Profit after tax also went up 37% year-on-year to 177.9 billion. On the balance sheet, we have our gross earnings, gross loans and advances going up to 2.3, going down to 2.3 trillion, recording a 4.6% drop year to date. Total assets was up to 5.6 trillion, 18% increase year to date. Customer deposits also went up 3.4%. 3.4 trillion, which is 15% year-to-date increase. We had total shareholders fund going up 16.6% year-to-date to 821.7 billion. On other key ratios, we have loans to deposit ratio at 60.5%. This creates room for us to grow our loans because the maximum is 80%. We also have our liquidity ratio coming in at 69.7%. Against the statutory requirement of 30% for our bank. NPL ratio was up 4.7%. We have our coverage ratio at 143.4%. Capital adequacy remains very strong at 27%, while cost of funds went up to 5.2% because of the high yield environment that we operated in 2017. We also have net interest margin at 9%, and this is, we've done it as some adjustment, which I will explain on the slide when I get to the slide, so our net interest margin. Cost to income ratio, we're able to maintain it at 52.7%, while cost of risk went up to 4.3%. Also, our return on average equity was 23.3%, while our earnings per share came in at 5.66 cover. Slide 10, that's our profit and loss, which shows the bottom line profitability, which is driven by our core earnings. We have also here shows our gross earnings, which went up 46.7%, interest income at increased by 23%, and profit before tax, which I've mentioned earlier. We'll go to slide 11. That gives us the trend in our net interest margin and cost to income ratio. So we can see an increase in net interest margin from 7.7% in 2016 to 9% in 2017. As I mentioned earlier, we have had to make some adjustments because earlier we had mentioned that the interest expense on some of our interest-bearing liabilities were being captured while the income was reported under trading. So we had to bring it up. That's why you see some adjustment between 2016 and 2017 to reflect that. On cost-income ratio also, we've seen that being flat at 52.7%. We are committed to keeping this cost-to-income ratio under control, and in the midterm, we target to get it below 52%. Our PBT increased by 30% year-on-year, as mentioned earlier, from 156.7 billion in 2016 to 203 in 2017. While we had our PAT coming in at 178 billion in 2017, recording an increase of 37%. We go to the next slide, which is slide 12. That shows our interest income diversification. We can see the breakdown of our interest income showing 23% in all interest income, driven mostly by treasury bill income because of the high yield environment. We're able to switch our assets effectively to make sure that we earn positively on treasury bills and other risk assets. Also, we saw our loans and advances increase as a result of still the high yield environment. Also, there's a breakdown showing the percentage contribution of most of these investment lines to our total interest income. The next slide is slide 13, and that also is on net non-interest income diversification. We recorded increase in most of the lines, and majorly the total non-interest income increased by 119%. Again, driven by most of the income lines like credit-related fees, which increased 13%. Our account maintenance fee also increased, showing increased activity in most of the accounts. We also had other lines of income, treasury bill trading income increasing materially. We have derivative income increased, financial guarantee. Effectively, we recorded increase in most of the lines of income under non-interest income. On slide 14, we have a breakdown of our interest expenses, which also recorded an increase of about 50%. You will realize that current accounts, which historically had less interest expense attached to them, but in the period of customers waiting out for FX and all that, so they had to request for interest payment on some of these current accounts. So that accounted for the increase we noted year on year of about 143, in addition to increasing the balance on itself. So we also had time deposits, savings account expense also increased. Borrowed funds, because within the year, 2017, we issued our $500 million bond, and that also accounted for the increase noted on borrowed funds. Slide 15 gives us also a breakdown of operating expenses, which we had inflation rates, naira devaluation, and information technology, contributing significantly to the 30% increase in total operating expenses. We've broken down most of the items that caused the increase. We have the basic ones like AMCON premium, which increased 14%, NDIC premium increased as our deposit balance increased, and other items that had foreign currency component, like advertisement, information technology, increased as the foreign currency depreciated a bit in 2017. Slide 16 is our balance sheet, a breakdown of our balance sheet, which shows a strong and liquid balance sheet led by loans and security portfolio. Also, slide 17 is a continuation on our liabilities and equity, which also shows that we have a strong base to fund most of the assets that we've created. On slide 18, that gives us the balance sheet currency breakdown, shows the diversification of our funding base and matching of our FX loan exposures. So that's given, and a breakdown of that is given here. It also shows us the mix and the contribution of the different currencies to our balance sheet, our loans and deposits. On slide 19, we have a trend in our loan growth, deposit mix, and that also shows in loan growth, we noticed there's a drop in 2017 compared to 2016. And what we've done here is to switch most of our assets to high-yielding and less risky assets like treasury bills, and that also accounted for the increase in income on treasury bill that has been noted earlier. Also, we were able to grow our deposit 15%, and our deposit has continued to be more of demand deposits, which contributed about 53% of our total deposit. Also for loans, we have term loans as a major loan we had in 2017 compared to other classes of loans. Slide 20. It's a breakdown of our liquid assets, which remains very strong, increasing by 49% year on year. And majorly, we have increase in treasury bills by 68%, which I've mentioned, and that's also related to the income that was mentioned in our presentation. Also, other classes of liquid assets recorded increase. Overall, it was a 49% increase. And our funding mix also shows a 20% increase. Customer deposits remains a major source of our funding, contributing about 64.5% of our total funding. Slide 21 is a breakdown of our performance by geography. Nigeria continues to be a major driver of our profitability, contributing 91% of our gross earnings. Other African countries contribute 7.2%, while Europe contributes 1.9%. Slide 22 also shows our performance by business segment. On gross earnings, we have corporates contributing at 65% of our gross earnings, while SMEs contributed 22%. Retail was 3.8%, while the public sector contributed 9.5%. Slide 23 shows a breakdown of loans and deposits by business segment. Again, on deposits, we have corporates contributing about 55%, SMEs 23%, public sector was 3.8%, while retail contributed 18% of our total deposits. Loans, also we have the corporates 67%, SMEs 19%, public sector 13.8%, while retail was 0.5%. On slide 25, talks about our risk management strategy. We'll continue as we have always done to ensure a coordinated approach to our risk management. We have our NPL coverage ratio coming in at 143%. We also have our NPL ratio at 4.7%, notwithstanding the challenging environment that we operated in 2017. We have continued to keep watch on most of the big loans in the different sectors to make sure that we take care of the risk inherent in these loans. Also, as a strategy, we have made sure that our loan portfolio is well diversified, as shown in slide 26, to make sure that the areas of concentration is well taken care of at all times. Slide 27 shows the breakdown of our NPL by sector. We have oil and gas contributing about 37.42% of our NPL, and then transport contributing about 16% of our NPL. Also, we have also broken down in slide 28 our foreign currency loans and structured loans. Foreign currency loans to total loans was about 32% of total loans, with oil and gas contributing mostly about 18%. Also, on restructured loans, which we are restructured for to ensure that the cash flow matches the operations of the customer, we had that coming at 12% of total loans. Our liquidity remains strong, that's slide 29, and capital adequacy remains very strong. Capital adequacy is at 27% compared to statutory requirement of 15%. Also, liquidity is at 70% compared to our statutory requirement of 30%. Our capital is majorly Tier 1 capital at 94.7% of our capital. At this point, I'll hand over to the MDCO to go through the strategy and outlook for the rest of the year. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we'll just go straight to Q&A immediately before we round up. So let me just invite our distinguished audience for the Q&A session. Thank you.
Thank you. And ladies and gentlemen, if you do wish to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypad now. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing 02 to cancel at any time. And there will be a brief pause whilst any questions are being registered. And our first question comes from the line of Sunde Abeduye from FBN Quest. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. My name is Sunde Abeduye. My first question is on your derivative and T-bill trading income, which is dominating your FIFO results. We noticed that these two were about 80 billion out of 101 billion you reported in Q4. Your PBT guidance implies that they're going to remain strong. Can you explain how you intend to do this? That's question one. Secondly, can you provide us an update on Nine Mobile? We want to know how you've classified this exposure since you've not categorized it as an NPL. We've also noticed that you took a specific impairment charge of about 34 billion for the communication sector. Do you consider this adequate for your Nine Mobile exposure? Do you expect to take more costs going forward?
Okay, Mike will take your question on the derivative income. Mike, please.
Okay, thank you very much for your question. On the T-bills income and derivative income, they are quite related. The T-bills you are seeing in trading is a hedge for our derivative position. And so with time, you are going to see an increase in the income coming from T-bill because as we continue to hedge our derivative, the bill position will grow as it will. As our year-end December 31st, we had about 600 billion worth of T-bills and bonds in our position. And that should grow over time as we continue to hedge our derivatives. The derivatives income is this high because we are rolling over some of the ones that have matured. And as rollover, it throws up mark-to-market profit, which might ease over time. So we think 2018 will not be bad. We think we can maintain our performance if the environment remains the way it is.
Okay, thank you very much, Mike. On the issue of the Nine Mobile, the sale process is still on, and we are at the closing stages. And I will assure you that from a risk perspective, we in Zenith Bank will be very, very prudent, and we've done what we believe is very appropriate for us to do. Very soon, the sale process will be concluded. Thank you.
Just to add, what FX rates are you using for your books right now?
As conversion rates, as at the end, we use 330.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Aaron Agardia from EFG Hermes. Please go ahead, Aaron. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for the presentation. I guess a couple of my questions really would be a follow-up on what the previous caller was asking. Firstly, on the trading revenue, would you be able to elaborate on the structure or the dynamics of the FX swap that you have with the counterparty? And is the counterparty willing to continue with that FX swap, given that the FX market has significantly improved or the liquidity has significantly improved over the last 6 or 8 months? My second question is to do with your cost of funding. If I look at your interest expenses, especially the other borrowing costs, they're significantly increased in 2017. Would you be able to elaborate why? It seems quite strange, given that your loan-to-deposit ratio has significantly declined and your balance sheet positions, liquidity position seems to be generally strong. So it's quite strange that you're trying to raise so much expensive debt when you don't really need that level of funding. Likewise, if I look at your deposit costs, over the last 2 years, your deposit costs have been significantly higher relative to some of your Tier 1 peers. So if you'd be able to elaborate as to why that might be and if we should expect that to normalize anytime soon. And my third question is to do with OPEX growth. What kind of OPEX growth are you guiding towards this year? Thank you.
Okay, so I'll take the question on the derivative and FX swap. My notional principle, absolute notional principle for derivative in my books is about $3.85 billion, which is quite high. And I do this with a number of counterparties. And so far, it's been going on. So for clients who are converting their forward to spot, I've been swapping for them as well. I also have clients who have been buying futures, and then I have what I do with the central bank. So the swap is still quite healthy. The pricing, of course, should get a bit more challenged as rates come and as they get more comfortable. But as I said, if the environment as it is remains the same, we'll be able to sustain what we are doing. But having said, I also must mention that some of the mark-to-market profit I've taken will go off as we move towards par, as we move towards maturity. They're going to pay off some of these mark-to-market. And then don't forget, the hedges of these swaps is what we have sitting in treasury bills in our trading books. So the T-bill portfolio is a hedge for some of these derivative transactions we've done. And that's why it looks such massive. As we continue to grow the book, the T-bill portfolio will continue to grow as well. And the income on T-bill can only go up.
Okay. Well, what level do you borrow the T-bills at, or what's the rate that you get the Naira liquidity at on the swap?
So we talk in terms of interest rate differentials. If I take the cost of the dollars and the yield on the T-bills, my interest rate differentials comes to about 10% today. About 10% today.
But in both directions. So that's the aggregate.
Yes. So today my cost of dollars is coming down because the environment has improved, and then yields on T-bills are also coming down as well. So they are all moving in the same direction. But the spread or the interest rate differential is narrowing, I must agree with you, as things normalizes. But as I said, if things remain the way they are, we should be able to do as well as we have done.
Okay, and of the notional principle of $3.8 billion in derivatives, how much is the swap?
The swap is about $1.6 billion for all the counterparties.
Okay.
Okay, then you mentioned the cost of funds. Basically, in 2017, between April and May, we did our Eurobond $500 million U.S. dollars. And that contributed the increased cost that you're noting there. And the explanation that's just been given, most of the swap that's done and derivatives, this has supported that whole process. And that's why you see that increase on that line of borrowed funds. Aside that, we have also had some other bilateral funding that has also increased in volume, and that also contributed to the
Okay, now I get the Eurobond, but if I look at your blended cost of other borrowings, and which includes the on-lending funds that you have from the central bank, which I believe is at 1%, the blended cost comes in at 8.8%, which is significantly high, in my opinion.
I think what you should look at, what is the cost of funds? Cost of funds on the average is 5.2%. Real cost of funds. It is... Because check across the industry, it is not correct that compared to our peers in Tier 1, this is a very, very respectable cost of fund at 5.2. When you are looking at cost of borrowing on a standalone, that's a different thing entirely. On a from a Eurobond perspective, I'm sure you will have seen what our Eurobond is and all that in terms of what we are paying, the cost of that. So really, if you look at our cost of fund, real funding is actually 5.2 for all our deposits.
But again, deposit costs, if I look at deposit costs, last year you were paying about 4.2%. I mean, with respect, the other Tier 1 banks were paying around 3%. And you know, historically, Zenith used to be lower than that. So I just like to understand why there's been a big shift in the last 2 years.
Why you even look? See, the point is, interest rate is driven by so many things. The macroeconomic environment affects rates. Look at the end of the day, I'm sure you will have seen what our net interest margin is. It's 9%. It has grown aggressively. And there's no way you will achieve that if you don't watch your cost of funding. Look at the yield on treasury bills. At some point, it was as high as 19%. There's no way the cost of funding will not go up in response to the direction of the yield on treasury bills. Now it is trending downwards, and we are now having cost of funding even coming down. So if you look at cost of funding generally, I think for 2017, what we have is actually very respectable. But as a bank, while we watch our cost of funds, our net interest margin is essentially very, very key to any bank at all. But either way, when you look at it, what determines your profitability is your net interest margin. And at 9%, I think it's a very comfortable position to be in.
Okay. And lastly, on the OPEX growth for this year?
Yeah, the OPEX growth, we have 51.9% guidance.
52, yeah.
That's the cost-to-income ratio.
OPEX growth. We usually try to match inflation. We had some significant individual costs last year, and that's why it went all the way up to 30%. But usually we match inflation or stay below inflation. So as inflation is coming down, we hope and expect that OPEX will be below inflation.
How do you measure the cost income? Because if I look at your cost income ratio last year, it was a lot lower than what is in the presentation. So is this excluding the trading gains, or how do we get to that 51-52% mark?
Is it OPEX?
Okay.
Yeah, every year.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Victoria Seo from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. Thank you for hosting this call. I just had a few questions. The first one is that we've noticed that your NIM drivers are usually always volatile. I wanted to ask what's driving that and what's your future outlook for that. Also, NIR contribution to total operating income is at an all-time high, suggesting that a higher portion of earnings is at risk. How do you see this line evolving this year? And also, what were the drivers of the higher cost of risk that you reported?
I think the first question you asked, or rather, when you say high percentage of our income is at risk, I think it's important for you to, Mike actually explained, what is the component of this trading income? If you look at the component of the trading income itself, you'll find out that you have essentially three parts to it. You have the trading in treasury bills. For a commercial bank, it will always be there. You have the trading in bonds and other government securities. It's always going to be there. Then you now have the derivatives. So I don't see what you will say is largely at risk. Banking is not about managing risk anyway. So I will tell you that if you check over time, these particular lines will continue to be there as we big our treasury will continue to trade in treasury bills, they will continue to trade in bonds, and they will continue to trade in derivatives. So we are not too concerned about that at all, because we believe that this particular trend, we should be able to maintain that.
Okay. What about the drivers of the higher cost of risk? So your cost more elevated.
So we made more aggressive impairment charges on some particular sectors. You will see increased impairment from the telecom sector. You will see in oil and gas. You also see in transport and aviation. So those are the particular sectors that contributed to the higher cost of risk.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Olaleta Nolaberto from Vatida Capital Management. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. Thank you for taking my question. I have two questions to ask. So the first one is about your NPLs by sector. I see that as of 2016, power sector, for example, had an exposure of about 43%. Now in 2017, it's down to about 0.01%. I also see a significant jump in transport and oil and gas. Can you please give an explanation to that? Second part is that somewhere in your report, I see that you have that the implementation of, or the impact of the implementation of IFRS 9 is going to lead to about 42 billion shave up in your shareholders fund in 2018. Can you also please give a better explanation for that? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me just take you on the issue of the provisioning for the power sector. Yeah, one of the provisions that we had in the power sector, the loan is performing now, no outstanding, and we even have some prepayments, so that had to be declassified. And in the other sectors that you mentioned, yes, we have a provision there, which Stanley mentioned earlier, that's the transportation. We had a provision for that in that particular sector, and the oil and gas. Then on the issue of the IFRS 9.
Yeah, the IFRS 9, what we said that we believe, looking at the position as at 31st of December 2017, should we have considered IFRS 9, which talks about expected loss and all that, that would have had additional impairment charge of 42 billion. So that implies about 2% drop in our capital adequacy ratio. So what we have elected to do is that will be adjusted in 2018 to our retained earnings. So that's the approach we have elected to apply. So that was a requirement and that note in the financial statement of 2017.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Kevin Jung from Prince Street Capital. Please go ahead, Kevin. Your line is now open.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. Could you just give us more color in terms of cost of risk guidance, you know, this year as well as just the general outlook? You know, is it possible that you guys return to, you know, normalized levels, you know, before last year? And then on the effective tax rate, you know, that dropped several hundred basis points year on year. So what, you know, what's the outlook for that going forward?
Okay, on the effective tax rate, of our huge investment in treasury bills, our tax is currently based on our dividend payout. At the end of the day, if you do our tax computation, our accessible profit is always lower than our dividend payable. So because of that, our tax will be based on dividend. So what we have done is to use dividend because since it's always higher to estimate our effective tax rate. That's why it's this level. Then on the cost of risk, we have also given a guidance of 3.10% for 2018.
All right,
thank you very much. Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Shania Mohammed from Perfect Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I just have a few questions. First is on 9Mobile. You addressed this earlier, but I'll just like to get, you know, the particular specific provisions you've taken till date. And on the trading income line, you discussed that it's on account of some of the rollover that you did. It would just be good, please, if you can give us the average maturity profile of your swap positions currently. And you also mentioned that pricing is definitely lower given the recent interest rate trend. But yet you expect to sustain this line. So it will be good to understand how you're looking at this. And sorry again if I'm making you repeat some of the things you talked about earlier. Also, my last question will be on your approach to IFRS 9. I imagine you give more details on this later, but I'd like to understand whether you've used static assumptions, particularly when it comes to things like exchange rates and interest rate assumptions versus, I guess, a more dynamic approach, which would, require building out a yield curve and the like. It'll just be to get a better understanding of, you know, how you're approaching this versus other banks, given, it's quite subjective. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's start with the question on the trading income. Mike.
Yeah, so as I said, we've been rolling over some of the stocks that matured. I'll approach it from a duration point of view. The duration of my swaps, of my derivatives, is around 9 months now. But as we roll over, we are extending the duration out into next year. And we hope to roll over most of the ones that are maturing. So duration will probably go above 2018. I also said the interest rate in dollars and naira are both coming down. So we hope to maintain the spread, the interest rate differential between the two. And as long as we're able to maintain the spread, we'll be able to maintain our level of income. But don't forget, I mentioned that some of the income we've taken, mark-to-market income, that we might lose some over time. I think you should have that in mind as well.
Stanley, on the IFRS?
Yeah, so we're not using static assumptions. We're using the yield curve. So that's what we've done under the IFRS 9.
Okay, thank you very much. On the issue of the mobile company, I think I rather would speak on sectors rather than talking specific on obligors, really. And I mentioned earlier that for the telecoms, you will have seen what we've done in the telecom sector. And I think we've been very, very prudent. The sale process is still on, and whatever the outcome is, we'll take it off from there. But from what we've seen, we've been very, very prudent based on the details we have on the proposed transaction itself.
Sure. Just a quick follow-up. Your guidance on loan growth, I'm assuming that excludes FX impact, is that correct? And I'd like to understand what sort of sectors you're seeing opportunities to lend to. That will be all. Thank you.
So the loan growth, you see, from where we are now, we don't even see any issue in terms of the FX impact itself. Because if you look at the exchange rate as it is, we're even assuming that we will operate at these levels, for 2018. You are actually talking of real growth when you look at the guidance that we've given. In terms of where do we see the opportunities, I would actually say that we see these opportunities, they cut across different sectors, not just one particular sector itself. What is important to us is, yes, while the sector is important, the obligor is also equally important. But we are very confident that the modest low growth that we've guided will be able to achieve it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Getinyati Lumulo from RM Investment. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hello. Thank you for taking my questions. This is Kayode Omoshibi from ARM. A part of my questions has been answered, but I just want to get some clarifications. One is regarding your funding cost. So you're giving a guidance of about 4.2% funding cost regards to 5% growth in deposit this year. So I want to get an answer of what your strategy is, considering that most of your increase in deposit is largely coming from your demand, and you're also seeing that high term deposit. That's it. Then secondly is about your USSD banking. Just want to get some clarifications on the number of transactions that may go in there in terms of number of customers and accounts, and how do you intend to grow that over time from that and its contribution to your non-interest income over the year?
Well, let me put it this way. Starting from the issue of digital banking, specifically you talk about USSD banking. USSD banking, really, if you look at the objective, is to actually penetrate a lot of the unbanked and also to provide that convenience for a lot of our customers who are not using smartphones as it is. And we have a massive pool there. What I can assure you is that we've been recording successive growth month on month, and it's like an emerging sector for us. So we expect that we are still going to grow very strongly in that particular area. It's still contributing to our commission income, that our non-interest income, and we expect that for 2018, we even expect that it will grow further.
Okay, but in terms of number of accounts, can I have an estimate of the number of transactions in terms of account, number of accounts that go through?
The number of accounts does not necessarily translate into number of transactions. What is key is, are we growing in this particular area? If I tell you, look, we have 5 million USSD users as against maybe 3 million last year, it doesn't actually translate into count and the actual volume itself. But the key thing is that it's a major growth area. I don't want to start delving into the number of transaction counts that we have, because that's information I don't have it here.
Okay. Then in terms of your funding cost, your guidance for 2018, I want just some more specifics of where the driver will come from, considering your composition of your deposits and the 5% growth in deposit for this year. I want to understand what the driver is and what the strategy is to drive this funding cost down.
You know, you even mentioned that our growth, you saw quite a lot from demand deposits. The fact that we have the yield on government securities dropping, rates are actually dropping. And we on our own, too, are driving that aggressively. The more our demand deposit grows and the mix is tilted towards demand deposit, invariably our cost of funds will come down. And that is what we expect in 2018.
Okay. Just lastly, just to be in line with what was explained on the derivative line. So it was said that the trade on the FX trading leg, the mark-to-market positions, getting closer to majority, we start to close. So does that assume that most of the like 39 billion booked in Q4, getting closer to the majority of your 9 months duration, we start to see the gains actually close up? I want to be sure of what you're saying.
Well, because I'm rolling over some of the ones that are maturing, it will be a blend. So I'll be having new set of income coming for the rollovers, and I'll be losing some of the old ones that are passing. So it will be good for me to give you an exact figure of how much you are going to lose over time, because I'll be rolling over, expect to roll over what the ones that are maturing.
Okay, but so in the last 3 months, have you rolled over any of your swap or derivative positions?
A number of them. I've done a number of them. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Ida Green from Valio Alliance. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Thank you. My first question, I guess, is around your cost of risk. I just noticed that it was 2.7% as at Q3, and it went up to about 4.7% as at 2017. So could you please share a bit of clarity on that movement? My second question will be around your trading income again. I know Mike sort of clarified one or two things, but are you able to detail like the minimum interest rate differential at which the swap transactions will continue to remain attractive for your bank? My third question is, I think, around your loan book or your yields on assets with specific reference to your loan book. Are you able to, I guess, detail what your typical average yield on local currency loans are, and also your typical average yield on foreign currency loans are? And similar question with regards to your deposit group and deposit book. Can you provide like what your average savings yield is versus your average term deposits yield? Well, yeah.
Okay, thank you very much. You see, let's look at this. It's time to talk about the issue of cost of risk coming down. But I think I even want you to look at this from a bigger picture. Look at the macro environment in the last 3 years. You've seen what happened in terms of commodity prices, particularly oil, the oil sector. Even Nigeria itself, we said we were in recession and we're just coming out of it. Naturally, it's bound to affect the risk structure in assets. So when you talk about cost of risk going up, I don't think anybody should really be that surprised, because these are part of the fallout. We all know what happened in the oil and gas sector from 2016, all the exposures that the industry faced. So cost of risk going up, I think that itself will even give a very good base to explain why we had those high cost of risk. And we expect that for 2018, this will actually moderate because we've been very aggressive in terms of taking care of the downside. On the yield on our average loans, deposits, savings, and all that, I think what you should focus on really is more of what is our net interest margin as it is, even when you aggregate all this. Because on its own, even when you say savings is even fixed by the central bank and all that. The other rates you are talking of, they are even advised on daily basis in the newspapers. Actually, we publish all that. But at the end of the day, the bottom line is, even when you get all these deposits, what of your assets, you get all your assets, what is your net interest margin? And that's what we've always focused on, that if people, most people are concerned, rates are coming down, banks are in trouble. But the key thing is for you to look at your net. If you have your eyes on your net interest margin, I think you will be able to come out with a respectable bottom line. Thank you. Then on the issue of the swap transaction.
Yeah, please just consider the swap as an arbitrage opportunity. And as long as it's an arbitrage opportunity, as long as you have a positive yield on it, you should continue to do that. It will become a game of volume because you are not taking any credit risk here. The risk you run is interest rate risk. But if you match it with your hedge by buying T-bills to match exactly when the swap is maturing, it becomes a pure arbitrage opportunity. So for the bank, as long as we have that opportunity and it makes sense, I think we'll continue to do it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Craig Metherill from AVO Capital Markets. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for the opportunity. Just to start off with, in your risk management strategy, you talk about hedges on your oil exposure. Can you perhaps just explain exactly what level that is at, what price level that is at, and what the hedge is, what the structure of that looks like? And then just in terms of your capital adequacy position, currently sitting on 27% and you guide for 24.2% in 2018. Obviously, I assume that's taking into account the impact of IFRS 9, but you allude to modest loan growth, a small impact on capital because of that, and obviously growing the T-bill portfolio, meaning no impact. What is the thinking on this excess capital? Is there any decision to perhaps pay out increased dividends, or how are you looking at that in terms of deploying it? Thank you.
Okay, on the capital adequacy, I think even from this year, we've been very aggressive in dividend payout. We're paying about the highest that has been announced in the banking industry today. For us, that's a way to say, okay, part of our capital, which we believe is strong, that we'll be able to reward the stakeholders and investors, the shareholders. Aside that, on the impact, yes, we're factored in the impact of the IFRS 9. That's why we're projecting something the lower. We said IFRS 9 impact will be about 2% on our capital adequacy. So that has been factored in. Overall, we believe that while we're doing all this, we also believe that we're going to earn more. I mean, as we earn, it also affects the capital adequacy computation. Those kind of earnings comes in. That's why we have looked at all the parameters and arrived at about 24.5 or thereabout as possible our listing for 2018 capital adequacy.
So, sorry, just jump in. Are you happy to sit on that large amount of excess capital?
Yeah, because based on the businesses we need to do, we believe that it's adequate for the kind of risk we take in this environment. We believe that we'll continue to run this business at those levels of a buffer because it's well required here.
And I think it's important to note that, you see, when you look at the type of environment that we are in, especially in the emerging markets globally, it's still very important for you to have these buffers. Otherwise, if you look at the events of 2016, 2017, we will have been running all over the whole place looking for capital. But when you run your business, it's a commercial bank. We're a very large bank, about the largest bank in the country. We cannot operate on edge. We've always had the strategy of operating with adequate capital. But the only thing we can promise is that we will always be very profitable, and our returns on average equity will continue to improve.
Okay, thanks. And then just on the oil price hedges.
Oil price hedges. Yeah. You know, we've ensured that with events that have happened, most of our loans in the oil and gas sector are properly hedged. We've ensured that as a matter of policy.
At what level? At what price level?
Well, we hedged them around the level we restructured the loans, and loans were restructured around $40 per barrel. So most of the hedges are around $40 per barrel.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Michael Ovelias from Stanbic. Please go ahead. Your line is now open. To the line from Michael from Stanbic, your line is now open to ask a question. And as we do not seem to get a response, I will now go back to the next question. Our next question comes from the line of Monica Ogunbulele from Standard Chartered Bank. Monica, please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Good afternoon. This is Oyinkon from Standard Chartered Bank. I have two questions. First question is on the drop in revenue, public sector. That went down from 16.5% to 9.5%. Why was responsible for that? And I know you had mentioned that you restructured your power loans. Your power loans became performing. Can you talk a bit more about the 22% that was restructured?
No, let's even start with the public sector that you have. You say the revenue dropped.
In terms of percentage, of the group, the share of the
okay. So, I mean, that one is understandable. We've always said is that look, even when you look at the public sector as it is, you'll find out that you are not having any increase in exposure in that particular sector. It's not a sector we are emphasizing as it is. From a risk asset perspective, you will have seen the drop. So that itself will explain to you why you have the drop in terms of the percentage or what the public sector accounts for in terms of our revenue, and it will likely continue along that line. For the power loan, the one that we said was declassified, it was not because of a restructuring, that specific one. It's the fact that the loan is performing. All past due cleared, and they even had a prepayment. I think that was the point I made. Not because we've restructured and it's now performing. No, that's not normally a basis for declassifying an account. You must see actual performance.
Even when it is restructured, if it is performing in restructured terms for at least 1 year, you are allowed to declassify as well.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from the line of Constantine Rosenthal from JP Morgan. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for the presentation. First question I wanted to ask is related to what you already commented on. That's the nature of the trading and derivative gains that you recognized in the fourth quarter and throughout the full year. So could you please maybe mention in a bit more detail what specific business are you doing here? So what exact positions, possibly largest position you're taking in this business that make you recognize these gains? On a net basis in the derivatives portfolio, are you long or are you short domestic yields, domestic Nigerian yields? And separately, what is the size of the notional of the derivatives portfolio which attributes to the Central Bank of Nigeria? That's the first block of questions. Secondly, I wanted to ask on asset quality side. So we've seen that there was quite a bit of an increase in loan impairment charges in the fourth quarter of previous year. Could you please give the reasoning for this and how recurring you think this would be? And also in terms of the general outlook for the asset quality in the sector and the Nigerian banking sector, what's your guidance? What areas of weakness do you see there and how do you expect it to perform this year? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your question. In terms of size, I've said we are exposed to about $3.85 billion in the derivative book. For obvious reasons, I can't tell you specifically who is accounting for what. In terms of yield exposure, on the swap side, I'm negative yield on the swap side, but on the hedge side, which is where the T-bills is, I'm positive yield. It's the net that is accounting for some of this massive income you are seeing in the books.
So on the asset quality, you mentioned in the fourth quarter. Yes, I mentioned earlier that we were very aggressive in impairment, making impairments for most of those loans. And these are not new loans. We don't have new loans going back. There are still historical old loans that we decided to make additional impairments on. So that's what has accounted for that jump you saw in the fourth quarter.
And talking about the outlook for the industry, I'll actually say it's probably difficult for one to, because one, the industry is very diverse. And you will have noted that for 2016-2017, NPLs have been on the rise. And you could see quite a lot of factors, the macroeconomic factors, the recession, the oil and gas challenges. But for 2018, going forward, I will expect that this itself should actually moderate, save for the legacy issues and other assets that will be non-performing arising from these events of the past. Next question.
And our next question comes from the line of Michael Ovelius from Stanbic. Please go ahead. Michael, your line is open once again.
Thank you very much for taking my question. I just wanted to know about your digital strategy, if you could elaborate further, and then also state if you've gotten to the breaking even point for the investments you've made into that space, or you're still trying to recover the initial investment. That's my first question. The second question I have is on the cost side also, in terms of your 30% increase in OPEX cost. I noticed that there was a significant jump on the IT line. So can you expatiate further on what are the drivers for that increase? And then the third question I have is on your, I noticed that there was an investment made into aircraft purchase by in your financials. Can you throw more light on that particular investment? Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Let me start with the digital investment and the break-even point. You see, the digital, as I explained, is a major cross of our retail strategy. And we're going to continue to invest in that particular digital space. We don't look at it as a short-term thing that you just invest and reap all the benefits now. The same as what you would do in a corporate finance transaction. If over time you continue to acquire your customers and you look at it and look, what exactly is the lifetime worth, value, or revenue you can derive from these your customers? So the key thing is we're going to continue to invest as to whether we've gotten to the break-even point. I think we're even just starting. I will expect that this will be a very, very profitable line for us going forward. The OPEX line for IT jumped up. Yes, that is expected because we were implementing a new banking application. So you will expect that that will account for IT spend. And also there's a lot of spend in terms of IT security. And IT security is extremely very, very dynamic because your safety, your security of your customers' funds, customers' information and all that is very, very key. So we continue to spend on IT security. And you also mentioned the issue of the aircraft. I don't see what much light to throw on that. Aircraft is aircraft. We have one on lease, and that's exactly what it is. I think it's very self-explanatory. Thank you.
The follow-on question I have to that is, so I asked you for a broad overview of your overall digital strategy. So what are the pillars? Is it just USSD or are there other pillars of that strategy?
You see, the main strategy, you see, the main focus of our digital strategy is the mobile. That is actually the direction we've agreed to go. It's not, USSD is just an element of that mobile strategy. Our core mobile banking application is also there. So what we want every customer to have or to enjoy is you have your bank in your pocket. And that's where we are going to. We don't want people to keep coming to our banking hall. With your mobile device, you should be able to consummate any transaction. That is the simple cross of our digital strategy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Moya Oni from SBG Securities. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, and thank you for the presentation. I have a few questions. The first is on your credit book and credit rating. Just looking through your financials, I noticed a marked improvement to about 82% of your obligors now have a rating of AAA to single A from 34% in 2016. And so I just wanted to understand what KPIs you look for to adjust the rating, and then also want to understand how that links to your cost of risk estimate, because I can see that it's still elevated for 2018. So just trying to understand how much of that is driving your expectations of elevated cost of risk. And then also what you see as a minimum, or shall I say, is split between your non-interest revenues and your net interest income. What kind of ratios do you see as a sustainable level for now, given that it's looking like derivative income, at least according to your disclosure, that it will be a regular driver of non-interest revenues going forward? And then thirdly, wanted to have an update on your oil and gas exposure and the performance of the restructured loans given improved oil prices. And so how is that affecting cash flows? And then beyond the oil and gas sector, your non-oil and gas restructured loans, how is the improving macro, or how is cash flows responding to the improving macro? And those are my questions.
Okay. I will just talk about the improvements in the rating for our AAA customers. As you well know, we've always had a differentiated customer base. We basically operate within the high net worth environment. Most of our huge exposures are actually to these customers. From the credit book you have seen, we found out that we didn't really increase our positions. Our exposure to these customers reduced, and many of them actually had better funded positions with us. So our exposure to them reduced, and the processes for looking at how they have improved their rating improved with us, and so we could see that there was improved rating for them. When you try to tie that to cost of risk, in our previous explanation, we have talked about the fact that impairment were in certain sectors and for certain groups. It was specific. It had nothing to do with general areas or sectors that usually we talk about. So because they were specific, they probably would not, a direct link of them may not be necessary because they are both.
No, I'm actually talking about forward-looking now. So your estimates for 2018. So even though it's a reduction relative to 2017, but it's much higher than where you were in 2016. And so I'm just trying to understand how that increased rating, or what that would mean to, or how you're seeing it linked to your cost of risk.
Okay. Now, you know, in 2018, we're operating under IFRS 9. You have expected loss model.
Loss position, yeah.
So that will have some impact on impairment, as it were. Aside that, we also have loans that we have already made provisions on. They will still be there in the books in 2018, and you can be making additional impairments on those loans. So, one, we're not expecting that we're going to create new loans that will go bad within this period. But for those that are already in the books that were already making impairments, you could make elevated impairment charge. We're also considering the impact of IFRS 9. So those are things we have looked at before we arrived at the estimate we've given for 2018.
And on the issue of the derivative, you were talking about the fact that we say, yes, we can sustain it. It's important to know that for these derivatives, for you to even go into it, number one, you must have very strong liquidity for you to be able to take advantage of this. And secondly, too, it's important for us to note that there's actually an opportunity cost to this derivative. If I don't do this derivative, does that mean that the money just lies on my balance sheet doing nothing? The answer is no. There are also other businesses that you can do, but the key thing is that you always look at from a risk perspective, from a yield perspective, which one benefits me better. So let's not have the mindset that, oh, this derivative will no longer be there, then because of that, your revenue just drops. That is not the position. There's also an alternative use of those, your liquidity, and we're very mindful of this.
So what will you say will be an alternative? Because I understand also that currently there seems to be limited appetite for foreign currency loans. So is it something that you are willing to look at if the opportunity comes?
You see, when you say foreign currency loans, there are different. There are different ways you can look at what you can apply foreign currency to. I don't want to go into too many details, but there are quite a number of short-term opportunities that you can still deploy those your strong liquidity in dollars to. And I can bet you most of them are what you can go in easily and the risk is very minimal. You might not get the same yield as your derivative, but the opportunities are there and they continue to be there. On the restructured oil and gas loans, yes, we've restructured some of our oil and gas exposures, and I'll say the good news is that for a number of them, in terms of production, we've seen the production rising, so that gives us a lot of comfort, and they are meeting their obligations as and when due, based on the restructuring that we've done.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question is a follow-up question from the line of Victoria Sia from Renaissance Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi. Sorry, in case you've already replied this question before, but I just wanted to know your cost of risk forecast for 2018, like what you're estimating, your guidance, and also for your tax rate as well. Then my third question is for the spike in cost of funds in the last quarter where it went from 3.9% to 6%. I just wanted more clarity on this and why it happened specifically in that quarter. Thank you.
Okay, good. For the cost of risk, we'll give a guidance of 3.10%. And for effective tax rate, we'll give a guidance of 13% for 2018. Okay, then for the cost of... Yeah, you mentioned about cost of funding increasing in the last the fourth quarter. Well, historically, we see that pressure always at the last part of the year, where customers will have opportunity to explore more yielding avenues to put in their funds. This is a period that we had other forms of investment in the market, like the treasury bond and all that. So those were all competing for the same kind of funding. And you needed to then defend your deposit that you have historically. And then that also accounted for the push up in the cost of funds, especially in the fourth quarter. If you look at the last quarter of every year, that's always an elevated cost. So it's not very particular to this 2017.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have further questions?
We have two more questions registered.
Okay.
And our next question comes from the line of Christine Fulparts from AllianceBernstein. Please go ahead, Christine. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for hosting this call. I had a couple of questions. The first was on your net interest margins. You mentioned earlier on the call that you included some of the trading income in an adjusted calculation for your net interest margins. I just wanted to clarify what that amount was just to reconcile. The second question is just following up on the oil and gas book and the increase in the cost of risk we saw there. Can you just comment or provide us a bit more color on, why I guess the provisions were taken at this stage on these legacy loans, particularly given that, a lot of the feedback has been that many oil and gas assets have been performing better. So I'm just kind of confused around the timing of taking these provisions and just what's going on with some of your specific oil and gas clients. In terms of the coverage ratio, I noticed it increased pretty significantly this year. So if you could just further explain the rationale for doing that this year. Lastly, on Nine Mobile, I know you touched upon this, earlier on the call, but it would just be helpful to just get a bit more color on, how your provisioning policy would change on that asset, just given where we are in the sales process currently.
Can you take on the net interest margin?
Okay, on the net interest margin, we'll have to explain that the expense regarding the funding for some of our investments, especially in treasury bills, the expense will be in interest expense line while the income was reported under trading income. So what we've done is to move that part that relates to that expense to make sure that we factor it into the computation of NIMS. What that was causing was to depress our NIMS because if we are considering the cost and not considering the income attributable to that, that showed a depressed NIM. So the amount, I think you said somewhere around, if you have what the breakdown of T-bill income, that portion, think about it's what we have considered in the competition.
So sorry, the portion of the trading income, that T-bill income is what you've included in that adjusted calculation?
That's what we've considered.
Okay, and you talked about the oil and gas loans that were restructured. We have 8.32 of oil and gas relative to our gross loans. And the question you asked as to why are we just making the provision now, I think it's important to know that provisioning is based on specific obligors. So because we're saying we have issues with oil and gas, all of them will not crystallize at the same time. But what we are looking at basically now is, since we are talking about IFRS, we are looking at expected loss. So when you have any of those loans show signs that of non-performance, we take provision immediately. So it is not about delaying, but it's actually about when do you expect that this loss will occur, or when you do identify that you have challenges with this particular loan. On the Nine Mobile, I think we've been very prudent.
Just on the oil and gas. So I guess one question would be, for those specific assets, what issues or what has changed that have led to those provisions? Is it that they've had production issues and challenges? I'm just trying to understand kind of what were the nature of the issues that led to that higher provision.
No, it's not production issues. You see, if you follow closely the oil and gas industry in 2017, the Transfocados pipeline was shut down for about 13 months. And that affected evacuation for some of the players that had to evacuate through that particular route. So if you have such a loan, that means that for those 13 months, they were unable to lift. So the prudent thing for you to do is to say, look, we expect that we have challenges in this particular area, and you just have to take, you just have to be very cautious. So that was a major factor, not necessarily the fact that they are unable to produce. The strategic health of the company is still good, but when you have for a whole 13 months, they were unable to evacuate, then you just have to do the prudent thing. On the Nine Mobile, as I explained earlier, we've been very cautious. We've looked at it. We've looked at the sale process, where exactly we are now, which is about being concluded. And we've actually taken a very prudent stance in terms of what do we expect that we're going to realize and what type of provisioning are we going to make. And I think that was what basically informed our decision on the sector.
So sorry, just to clarify, you don't have any provisions currently on that loan?
No. We've even said it before. Definitely, we have. That's why I said we provided for what we feel will be a potential haircut even after the sale.
And are you able to give that provision amount as a percentage of your loan exposure?
If you don't really mind, I don't really want us to go into specific obligors, because this is supposed to be a syndication where you have almost about 12 lenders. So, but what I can tell you, what I can assure you is, even right from if we check our half year, what we did, we've been very, very prudent when it comes to this particular asset we are talking about. And you know, we even explained that if you check what we have under collective impairment, it was a major factor there too.
Okay. And sorry, if I could sneak one last question in there, in terms of your growth, your 10% loan growth outlook, can you just comment on how that's tracking year to date? Are you starting to see that pick up in loan growth, or do you think that filters through more in the second half of the year? And what impact do you expect to see from the 2019 elections on that outlook?
Well, you see, the point is, if you check even the last election, the last two elections, I don't think it's a major factor for any serious business. If you are into manufacturing of toiletries, FMCG, you are not going to say because of election you go to sleep. People have learned to move on with their life and with their business. I don't see that affecting loan growth at all for any serious business. Some of these businesses that we learned to, they've been in the country for over 100 years. So in terms of at what point are we going to contract this loan, I'll probably say even right from this Q1, we're already seeing signs, and we're already even concluding those transactions. So I would say it actually span the whole 2018. If we're able to do that in Q1, the opportunities are there. We believe we can lend safely and come out safely. We'll even do it in one quarter if those opportunities arise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. Our last question comes on the line of Manre Baluro from Chapel Hill Denham. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi, good afternoon. Just a little clarity on IFRS 9, the impact on CAR for the year. And I did hear your explanation around the derivative income and your alternatives in the event, if you have to do something else, and your cost of fund or the opportunity cost behind that. Can you give more, should we expect similar performance on this line item in 2018? And in regards to your provisions, I know you were quite evasive around, what you provided for this Alat. It's a 35 billion specific impairments on your results. I'm assuming that's probably this Alat. And on the oil and gas, is it only the upstream players, or do you have any impairments that you apply to guys in the, midstream or downstream? And also in transportation, also there's a big chunk of an impairment that you guys took. Can you give clarity on who or what corporate in the transport industry that, about 13.6 billion in provisions that you made, or should I say impairments rather? Thank you.
Okay, you know, we've said it before. We're not going to talk about any specific obligor. We owe them that confidentiality to a bank. So if you don't mind, let's not go into specific about obligors. It's enough that we provided detailed information on the particular sectors that we've made provisions for.
Around IFRS 9 impact on your car.
Yeah, the impact we said is going to be 2% on car, and that we have factored into the projections given for 2018.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you very much.
Sorry, if there are no more questions registered, I hand back to you, speakers, for closing comments.
Okay, thank you very much for taking the time to dial in to our conference call. And I want to assure you all that we'll continue to compete aggressively for market share, but with very high focus on quality assets and top-end relationships, while also at the same time adopting cost reduction strategy. Customer service is in our DNA, and that is what we'll continue to focus on. We'll also try to develop specific solutions for each of the segments that we currently operate. And as we said earlier, our retail business itself, we see opportunities for growth. So I want to thank you all, and thank you very much for dialing in. Thank you, and bye for now.
This now concludes our conference call. Thank you all for attending. You may now disconnect your lines.